Hey, Sydney.
Hey, Samuel.
I think I've decided to become an author, and I've actually gotten started on my first book recently.
Okay. What's it about?
So it's following the main character, who's this really cool dude. He's married to this florist, and he decides actually that he hates her, and so he is constantly just abusing this lady. He cannot seem to do anything to make her break up with him, until finally she has the last straw whenever he takes her to watch this horror movie that she hates, about a clown from a sewer.
Whoa, what's it called?
I'm planning on calling it Us Ends With It.
Us ends with it. Sounds good.
Glad you're here on this Sunday. I'm gonna get right into the message. I'm gonna tell it like it is, as they say. Oh, I heard a hallelujah. Did you think I don't know what the hell is going on? And a lot of strange places. Where in the hell have you been? Hellfire! 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 All right. Okay, there's something else, too.
Hello and welcome to the Satire Fire, your number one outlet for Colleen Hoover reviews. I am Samuel.
I'm Sydney.
And we are back with another week, a final week of discussing Notes from Underground by Fyodor Dostoevsky. If you are unfamiliar with the podcast, if this is your first time joining us, first of all, welcome and thanks for checking us out. And second of all, just so you can get your feet underneath you, this is a podcast all about satire, where we talk about satirical books, sometimes satirical movies or songs or articles or newspapers or comics or whatever else we can find that is a satirical lens through which to view the dumpster fire of a world that the author happened to be living in at that moment. Right now, with this episode, we are ending our three-part series on Notes from Underground, like I just mentioned, where in part one, we did a plot summary telling you everything that happens in the book so that if you haven't read it or if it's been a while, you're all caught up and you are ready to learn about it. Part two was a context episode where we talked all about what was going on in 1850s Russia in order to prompt Dostoevsky to write this book. This book had a lot of context, and so I would highly recommend, if you didn't listen to that one, go back and give it a shot. It was a lot of fun to record, and I think it'll be a lot of fun to listen to, and all of that information is going to be important for this week's episode, where we are going to be analyzing the book, talking about the themes, talking about how the context helps us to interpret the book, and then ranking and reviewing and rating it. Is this book good? Is it effective? Is it enjoyable to read? Does it inspire us to build our own underground bunker from which to shout at passing clouds like an old, old man from The Simpsons? But before we get into any of that actual content, let's stall for a minute. Sydney, have you been doing anything or reading anything lately that you would like to tell the good people about?
Yeah, I'm gonna give you guys a recipe.
Hell
I know
yeah.
this is what you wanted from me. We're recording this at lunchtime, so I just had my lunch and I've been making this little wrap. And you could add a lot more to it. I'm keeping it simple, but I'm giving you the foundation of this wrap, and then you can get creative with it. It's a recent discovery of mine.
Sick.
It's really not that intricate. So, okay. So I was at the land that I love, Trader Joe's, and I was shopping.
From sea to shining sea.
shopping for something to have for lunch. And I kind of struggle with lunch, honestly, like what to eat, because I'm not someone that can eat a lot for lunch. It'll make me feel sick. I need to have like a smaller meal in the middle of the day. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like a lot of lunch options end up just being too much for me. But I was thinking in the realm of a wrap. In the realm of a wrap. And I saw these tortillas that are habanero lime tortillas. So this is the first start. This is the first thing you need to get is the habanero lime tortillas. And like, if you don't like spice, skip forward a few minutes because, sorry. but you start with those. And then I did pepper jack cheese. You can do whatever cheese you want. I'm a big pepper jack fan, especially for the theme that we've got going here. And then here's the shining item of the wrap. And bear with me. It's Trader Joe's soy chorizo. I'm not a vegetarian, but this stuff is the best thing you'll ever eat. Like the Trader Joe's soy chorizo, it's better than any non-vegetarian chorizo you'll have. I like chorizo, but like, I don't care if you're like, oh no, I want real chorizo. No, you're getting the soy chorizo. I'm putting my foot down. You're getting the Trader Joe's soy chorizo because it's so good. Like, it's just so flavorful. I love it. So, cheese of choice, Trader Joe's soy chorizo. What I like to do is cook the whole thing of chorizo, the whole like tube it comes in, and then just put it in the fridge so that you can, throughout the week, heat it up. You got your chorizo. And then from here, you can do whatever you want. You can add like some greens. You can add some extra stuff. I'm not going to tell you, but just make sure you have soy chorizo, the habanero lime tortillas. Those are the biggest items that I would like require you to put in this wrap, and then go crazy from there. I've never had this before. I like kind of a saucier, like I like sauce on things. So I don't like to be too dry. And so I'd never had this before, but they had this spicy dynamite sauce. That's what it's called at Trader Joe's. I put that on there. I think it's great. It's a little sweet, but still spicy. Adds a great depth of flavor. And that's it. You put it all together in a wrap. That's good for me just to have very few ingredients because it's not too much food for lunch. But if you need more than that, put some veggies, put some lettuce. You could even do some like pico. That could be fun. There's lots of options, but
there's so many food out there.
so many food. So that's my recipe. And really, I'm not sponsored by Trader Joe's. It might sound like it.
It's Trader Joe's. If you're out there, Joe, if you're listening.
Joe, if you're listening, I would love for you to sponsor not just our podcast, but me specifically. I love your soy chorizo. I'm the biggest fan. Also, that soy chorizo is so versatile. You can do so much with it. I also like to use it in a breakfast bowl. So maybe like some eggs, some soy chorizo. If you like hash browns or something, you can do that. You can do also a variety of veggie. You know, just like it's the protein of your breakfast bowl and eggs. Then I like to throw some hot sauce. I love hot sauce, so I like to throw that on top of my breakfast bowl as well.
Hell yeah.
But yeah, so this is a recommendation for the soy chorizo as well as the habanero lime tortillas. They're very good.
I've never...
Thank you.
I think I've shopped at Trader Joe's once and it was with you.
Oh. Wow.
And I've never had their specific soy chorizo, but I was vegetarian for a while and I would get just like, I think it was just called soy rizo. I don't even know what the brand is, but that's what it was called in the grocery stores that I would go to. And I got that a lot because I love chorizo and it is like very good. I don't think that specific like fake chorizo is as good as real chorizo, but it sounds like the Trader Joe's might be. So I will potentially give it a shot at some point when I can convince myself to go to a Trader Joe's.
What do you got against Trader Joe's?
I like cooking as opposed to heating things up.
Hey, I was cooking. I cooked soy chorizo. What about you? Any recipes to share with the crowd?
I don't know if I have any recipes. I do have a book to mention and recommend. If you personally can't make this book at home, then store-bought is fine. That's okay. it's the book A People's History of the United States by Howard Zinn. If you're unfamiliar, which I feel like it would be, I don't know. I feel like if you are in any way plugged into nonfiction historical books, this is one that you've probably heard of. It came out in 1980, so it's been around for a while, and it is credited with helping to reshape the narrative with which history of the United States is generally told, where, in case you're unfamiliar, in case this is the first time you've ever been told, a lot of times with history in general, and also specifically the history of the United States, the version of the narrative that is told is being told from the perspective of rich and powerful people. And so a lot of times you are being misled or misdirected when it comes to how or why certain historical events happened and what those looked like. And a lot of that is in service of crafting a very specific narrative about what the United States is and what the United States stands for. Because if they can convince you, they being the people who are in power at the times when these stories are being told, if they can convince you that a struggle is happening for a specific reason, then they can mislead you into either supporting that event or deriding that event based on how they specifically would like for you to feel. And this book is kind of a re-examining of a lot of those events that have happened, where it's looking at, well, in the Revolutionary War, was it actually the people that rebelled, or was it just the really wealthy merchants who were being impacted heavily by taxes at the time? When the Revolutionary War ended, was everyone really, really happy with the new style of government, or was it possible that poor people felt incredibly excluded? When it came to things like women's suffrage and the right to vote for people of color, was it really clear-cut, oh, we just suddenly decided that this is a thing that we wanted, or was it a lot of effort and fighting over years and years in order for this to take place? And it's really taking the history of the United States and a lot of the different conflicts that we see and reframing them by specifically pointing towards, really, this was a conflict of people who were really poor and people who had a lot of money. And then after the event took place, it was kind of recolored to look like it was something else in order to make it more palatable for future generations. And I found it really interesting and also really depressing a lot of the time.
You just keep the last week you recommended a nonfiction that was really interesting and depressing, and here you are again.
Yeah, so I think that this can be a book that is very empowering, because reading it, you understand that we in this current context are not alone in some of the struggles that we're facing. And so it helps you understand that you're just part of a movement that has been taking place for a really long time, and that you are not alone in this moment in history because of the way that you feel. However, you are also reading 700 pages of poor people losing. Like, at no point during the book is there really very many times where the victor of an altercation was the poor people as opposed to the rich people. And so it is a little bit depressing to read it and be like, damn, we've had people fighting against this specific problem for hundreds of hundreds of hundreds of years, and we still haven't won. So, I recommend it. I think that it is very well written, very well researched, very interesting. I would definitely recommend it if you are someone who has spent a fair amount of time reading about history of the United States, or if you're someone who's interested in learning about the history of the United States, but you are aware that sometimes history can be problematically retold. I think that this definitely has biases and is definitely trying to drive towards a specific narrative that you come away with a specific message. But I think generally speaking, it is one of the least biased historical accounts that I have read, based off of just the number and the variety of first person accounts that it's using in order to convey the message that it's leaving you with.
I know of that book, and I've on many accounts thought about, like, oh, that would be something good to read, but I've never taken steps to do it.
Like I said, I liked it. It is a commitment. It's a really long mm-hmm. book, and it's good, but it is very long, and it is not written in the modern style of nonfiction where the readability is really emphasized. It is a historical nonfiction book, and so it is rather mm-hmm. dense, and I think that it is told in an interesting way and an engaging way that helps you read through it and keep going and feel compelled to finish it. It doesn't get, like, super sloggy very often, but it's definitely not as engaging as something like Empire of Pain, where it is I would not describe this as a narrative nonfiction book. It is mm-hmm. just a nonfiction. So, with all of that introduction and prefacing out of the way, let's get into talking about Notes from Underground by Fyodor Dostoevsky. So, we'll see how much there is for us to talk about here. This is a really dense book. It's got a lot of moving parts. It's got a lot of themes and stuff that it's trying to talk about. But all of that really, if you listened to the context episode, you'll know, revolves around one specific parody or critique that it's trying to make. And so a lot of the themes that we're going to talk about can be summed down pretty easily. But Sydney, what do you want to start us off with? Is there a specific theme or idea that you wanted to talk about, or did you want to get right into talking about if it's effective or not, or where do you feel is a good place to jump in from?
I think that, like, my favorite thing thus far. Oh, I haven't finished the book. Let me admit, guys, I've just been so busy, but I've done my best research about it to be prepared for today. And also Samuel gave me an excellent summary and context episode. I do plan to finish it. I'll talk more about my thoughts so far at the end, but my favorite thing, I think, like, philosophical argument has been that, like, intense consciousness, like, if you're too conscious, then that will lead to inaction, which I think directly conflicts with, like, what I can't remember the author of
Chernyshevsky.
I think that directly conflicts with what Chernyshevsky was trying to say about, like, if we just were smarter, if we developed more consciousness, we'd be in a utopia. And I feel like Dostoevsky is making the argument that, like, if we develop too much consciousness, then we'll just, like, that'll lead to inaction and resentment. I don't know, that was, like, an interesting thought to me. I don't know how much there is to like discuss that, but I liked that topic.
I definitely think that he's making a point about how without action, nothing gets done. And I think that a lot of the arguments that he's trying to talk about or refute are ones that were based on how by changing the public consciousness, by enlightening people through the exposure of new elevated ideas and education and stuff like that, how through those efforts alone, society will naturally become better. Whereas Dostoevsky is really kind of taking the stand of, well, enlightenment is great, but if you don't do something about it, then nothing is going to happen. You can think about making society better all you want, but thinking about it doesn't make society better. And he's showing that by giving you a character who is so overly in their own head that they refuse to take any action to better their lives, to better the lives of people around them. They're just constantly obsessed with the thought of acting, that it makes them impossible to act. And I think that that's a really interesting statement to make, and one that is, to an extent, still very relevant today, of like, yeah, it's awesome that you're thinking about ways to make society better. Have you done anything about it?
It made me think a lot about several different like institutions that I've been either a part of or privy to because of my work like in journalism. But like, for example, you know, there's the idea of like the ivory tower and all of these well-funded major research universities doing research, but the system isn't set up to make that research accessible to the common people who it's allegedly intended to help. And so it's like, oh, you sit on your ivory tower saying we're so smart and we're figuring out the world's problems. And that's overgeneralized. That's, but it made me think of that idea of like, well, you're sitting up there, but what are you actually doing for me, the common person who isn't accessing this education and these resources that you are hoarding or what? It made me think of that. It also made me think of like government systems because they love committees. They love action, quote unquote, action committees. Like they're like, without getting specific, like I used to work in, actually, I don't know if I should say this, never mind. But they really like to create committees that are intended to come up with ideas for solving problems.
Yeah.
And they're using all the like politically correct language, and they're trying to change the lives of people who will never have a seat at the table that they're at. And they themselves have never been in, not, I mean, I, that's also a generalization, but often haven't been in the position of the people that they're trying to like create solutions for. And a major like one that I can think of in terms of like a societal problem that this is a big thing that there are committees created for is like substance use and addiction, which is very relevant to the Empire of Pain that we talked about last week. But like, without saying too much, because I don't know that I can really do that, I've watched committee meetings where people were discussing how to help people struggling with substance use, where it was just interesting. The way they were talking about it.
It's like
doing a lot of intellectualizing and talking, but not a lot of...
Yeah. A lot of people who want to talk about the problem of addiction and how we can solve it, where no one in the room actually carries Narcan in their pocket in order to help someone who's overdosing. Like the easiest and most basic and first step that you can do in order to help people in that situation, and you're really interested in intellectualizing instead of acting. It reminds me a lot of the book Grand Hotel Abyss, which is a nonfiction book talking about the Frankfurt School, where it was this school of philosophers and thinkers and critical thought leaders and stuff like that, where they were really interested in coming up with philosophical ideas and grand level ideas of how to make the world a better place. But the name of the book comes from the criticism of the school that everyone there was basically living in a beautiful hotel on a cliffside where they are living in the lap of luxury. But once a day, every day, they leave the hotel and go over and gaze down into the abyss and then go back to the school in order to write some more. Where it's these people who are disconnected from the struggle that is happening, and instead of participating in the struggle, are choosing to think about it and think about what it is that can be done to avoid the struggle continuing. And I think that it's a complicated topic. I think that it's a really tricky thing to discuss and nail down and talk about. Because it's like, I'm never going to say that having community discussions about unhoused people or having these internal discussions about the increasing of diversity in a company or addressing these societal problems, I'm never going to say that those discussions are wrong or bad or should not be happening. Mm-hmm. But it is an interesting situation to be in where those discussions are taking precedent or taking the place of actually acting in response to those causes.
Seems as if, you know, both are important.
Yeah.
And I think maybe that's like an interesting critique of both books, is that I think both they were taking like different sides of solution to a problem, but maybe if they would have just like come together, it would have been the best possible solution. I don't know.
Yeah, like you cannot fix societal problems only through discussing the problems and by trying to educate people about the problems. Like, that's not going to in and of itself do it. But also, you can't solve a problem just by having everyone out in the world acting in order to try and solve the problem without having some sort of a discussion of what direction are we moving in. Like, if everyone is just acting independently, then it's really tough without some sort of like a collective effort to have effective action. And so, like, you can't really have effective action without effective dialogue, but effective dialogue without action is as useless as ineffective action.
Do you think something I was thinking about, like with these two books, Notes from Underground and What Is to Be Done, is in What Is to Be Done, he's saying that you should be intelligent and conscious. You should seek intelligence. You should be super aware of your consciousness and your, you should think a lot about your decisions and how you move through the world. And so it seems, and I just want to know if you agree, if this is what Dostoevsky was doing in his like parody or in his clapback. It seems as though he wrote a character that was that, like, was super conscious.
Yeah.
But then instead of making him the like above ground part, the person that like in What Is to Be Done, it was like, this would be the ideal man.
Mm-hmm.
This would be the person to strive to be. He took that person and put them underground.
Yeah.
Like, so was that. And so the man in Notes from Underground isn't meant to represent like Dostoevsky himself necessarily anything. Yeah. It's meant to represent like mock, like what this guy said was who you should strive to be. But then it was interesting because the people above ground, the man underground, talks about how they don't question things and just act willy-nilly. And that's ridiculous. And so do you think Dostoevsky was saying, like, that's what we should do? We should take more action, do less questioning, less, like, I don't know.
I think that the man underground is meant, like you were saying, to be someone who took the ideas of Chernyshevsky's book to the extremes and took them very mm-hmm. literally and became incredibly educated and internalized and conscious and all of these things that resulted in him becoming a person that now is a recluse from society and lives underground. And I think that what they're trying to point out, or what he's trying to point out with that, is that Chernyshevsky was saying, oh, normal people live below ground, whereas enlightened people are surface level. They're just normal people and everyone else is below them living in underground tunnels. And flipping that on its head, Dostoevsky, I believe, is saying, no, normal people are just walking around. Normal people are just normal people, and they're walking around and they're living their lives. And for you to say that acting on your thoughts and your impulses and your beliefs and your desires and all these complicated things, taking those things and turning them into action, does not make you a brute or less than or a troglodyte or whatever. I think that it's just trying to say that there are two ends of the spectrum, and going too far in either direction is negative for you as a person and also would be negative in aggregate within society. Like, if you are not thoughtful enough, then you become a bad person. But also, if you're so thoughtful, you also are just not a cool person to hang out with and be around. Like, nobody wants to be with you if that's the way you're going to act.
Yeah. Another thing that I've been thinking about is, like, what is Dostoevsky saying about, like, interpersonal relationships, like with the relationships you have with others. Mm-hmm. I mean, I feel like we touched on it a little bit, like if you're lame and weird, like no one's gonna want to hang out with you. Mm-hmm. If you're thinking too much. But obviously, like the man who's living underground, the man underground,
mm-hmm.
Is a character that Dostoevsky doesn't like. He's like, don't be like this guy. And so, like, there's this one part, I read this recently, so it, like, made me laugh, where it's the part where the man is wanting to go with his old school friends to their lunch,
mm-hmm.
And they didn't invite him, but he's, like, trying to get invited. He's trying to, like, just go. And Simonov, one of the friends, is like, oh, you want to come too? Like, asks him that question. And then it says, he knew me by heart. It infuriated me that he knew me by heart.
Yeah.
And I don't know why that line specifically, but I was like thinking about it. And I was like, is he trying to say that like too much intellectualism will take away from your ability to like have, like you should prioritize empathy and relations with other people and... I don't know. Like, I feel like there's something here about, like, relationships with others and the value of them. But I don't know. Because this guy is so isolated. And it's because of his, like, hyper-intellectualism.
Yeah.
And, like, and so I'm like, what is he saying, if anything, about the importance of having relationships with people and also about, like, the way to do that? Like, I don't know, did you have thoughts on this?
I agree with you that I think there's something there, just because it shows how much the underground man wants to be able to relate to other people and mm-hmm. wants to be able to have friends and friendships and stuff like that. But it's making, I think, a statement on the fact that he can't have those things because basically at every turn, he's trying to view himself as superior to everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
And forcing a dynamic in which every time you talk to someone else, you view yourself as enlightened and superior beyond what they are. That's a really good recipe to not have friends.
Mm-hmm.
I think that a lot of the interest from the book comes from the dichotomy between how much this guy sucks and how much you want to dislike him versus how often he is an empathetic character, where you can mm-hmm. kind of see the like flashes of humanity trying to push through that intellectual consciousness air that he's trying to project, mm-hmm. where there's like moments where it's like, oh, he would like to be a normal person, but he can't be a normal person because he has taken all of these ideas too close to heart. And I think that that's like one of the things that I was going to talk about that is like relevant throughout the book, that the book is referencing both Dostoevsky's own experience as well as what is to be done by Chernyshevsky. The idea of the Crystal Palace, where I think that the Crystal Palace is really meant to symbolize the idea of a utopia as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's a really important section of the book when it comes to interpreting the book and interpreting the character of the Underground Man, that he talks so much about hating that Crystal Palace, but mm-hmm. then as he discusses it more and more, ends up turning around on its head and being like, actually, I love the idea of a crystal palace, and I hate the fact that I love the idea. Where I think that that's taking some moments to reflect what Dostoevsky's actual beliefs were. Where Dostoevsky very vocally disliked the class system of Russia that allowed people to be like peasants and serfs, and other people to be these powerful rulers and leaders and oligarchs almost. And he really wanted that system to be changed in order to promote equality. And he was an advocate for, we should do things to benefit poor people. Poor people should not be miserable the way that they are.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that in his heart, Dostoevsky wishes that something like the utopia put forward in What Is to Be Done could exist. And I think he wishes it was as easy as Chernyshevsky is trying to make it seem.
Mm-hmm.
But in his heart, he's like, it is not that easy. And if we pretend like it is that easy, we're only going to push ourselves further from one another and push our society further from ever realizing something like that. Like, I think that at his heart, Dostoevsky is a realist almost, where he's seeing these ideas and saying, that would be awesome. No shot it's going to happen, though.
I think that, like, this is such a trademark of, not satire, but it can be, especially a lot of the satire we've read so far on the podcast, of this discussion or like this discourse or even just like the undertones of can utopia be real? And mm-hmm. if so, how do we get there? Or can it not be at all? And is trying only going to cause blank problem? Because I think that like Brave New World, 1984, Fahrenheit 451, Slapstick, and even like Lula Dean's Little Library of Banned Books, like at the end there's kind of a little utopia of a sense. And it's like, it's interesting how some authors who write satirical novels are idealistic in a way that they hope or even think that you can achieve a semblance of a utopia.
Yeah.
While others are more realistic and they think, no, that's not necessarily something we should strive for. Maybe instead, let's try to make these small changes.
Yeah.
And day-to-day life. And this is such like a through line of this genre. Yeah. And it's cool that this book is kind of like, it's like the philosophical text about this through line.
Like, I think that a lot of, particularly the authors that we've already read, could be described either as idealists or as nihilists.
Mm-hmm.
Where either you see the world as having intense potential to become something beautiful, or you see the world as inherently flawed and a negative place to reside in, or go, it's trending in the wrong direction almost.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that this book is really straddling that line in a way. I think that at surface level it feels very nihilistic of the utopia you imagine cannot exist. But I think that learning more about Dostoevsky and his background and the book that he is critiquing with this and what his beliefs were and stuff like that lends the book more towards an interpretation not of the world will always be bad, but an interpretation more of the world will not be made better through wishful thinking.
Yeah. I think it's also, I feel like sometimes you can become, like with nihilism, it can also, people who are nihilistic can be misanthropic as well and not see the good in humankind. But I don't think he's doing that. I think he thinks people are and can be good and sees the benefit of caring about people.
Yeah, I think that you can see that through the way that he handles every character that is not the Underground Man. He very clearly dislikes the Underground Man, but most of the other people are just like chill. They're just cool.
I think he just like, he likes the regular guy. Like, he's the working man's man. Like, he's like, I just like regular people. Like, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I would definitely agree with that. I think this was a really interesting book, if only because we've talked before about how a lot of times satirical authors will include snippets or sections where they almost like break the fourth wall, or in like wrestling terms, they break kayfabe, and they are telling you not through some sort of obfuscation what they feel. They're not telling you how they perceive the world using a literary device. They're just telling you. And I think that this is an interesting book where it's broken into two parts, and half of the book is just Dostoevsky telling you what he feels, but never breaking character. Like, he goes the entire time just saying, these are the exact ideals that I think you as a person should live by, but telling them entirely through this persona that does not agree with him even slightly. I found that so interesting and such a like brave artistic choice. Like, I cannot imagine the difficulty with which you come to the conclusion, I have to make my main character not just unlikable, but despicable. Like, the person that you are going to spend the entire book reading about and trying to empathize with in order to understand the point of the book, literally opens the book with the self-description of, I'm a wicked man. Like, I'm a bad guy. You should not like me. And I love how well he pulled it off. Because, yeah, this guy sucks the entire time, but I do feel bad for him a lot of the times. And I do feel as though I took so much of the story and so many of the themes away from the book that I was hopefully supposed to take away. Not just in spite of the fact that the main character is unlikable, but because of the fact that he's unlikable. I found that really, really cool.
Yeah. No, I agree. And I mean, like I was saying in the first week when you were doing the plot summary, like, there were times where I was like, oh, I think he's just sympathetic. Like, oh, I think, wait, this poor guy, like, he's trying.
He's just an empath, but he's so, he's an empath, but he's just got so many hangups, so much going on in his head that he can't.
He's an overthinker.
We've all been there.
Yeah, I have been thus far, like, thoroughly impressed with this book. I agree with you that it's such a feat, and it seems like it was a complex book to write. Mm-hmm. Like, yes, it's a diss track and it's funny in that way, but also the way that he created this character that was complex and both hateable and likable, and the way he used that character, and even like a narrative, like each piece of the narrative was intentional in the second part,
yeah,
to prove a point. Like, it's just such a thoughtful book, and he was able to tell you what he thought and what he felt, and also empathize with people who thought differently through this character. Like, I've been really impressed with, like, it as a work, a literary work.
Yeah.
Like, it just, it's really, I couldn't do it. I couldn't write something like that. Yeah. And it seems like smart guy. Like, it's one of those things that, like, you might read in, like, a college philosophy class and you will really enjoy talking about with your classmates, but also, like, I feel like you'd have to read this so many times to catch all the pieces of it that,
yeah,
are making a point or making a, like, there's just a lot. It's a lot. It's really dense, like you were saying. Mm-hmm. For something so short. And I feel like that's what was taking me a long time in the first part, especially because, yeah, I'm just like, I mean, I think I'm an intelligent person, but, like, I was having to, like, reread things to be like, wait, what?
Yeah. There's a lot of versions of the book out there. For sure, if you want to read this, make sure you get one that includes footnotes, because he's making, mm-hmm, so many literary references and references to events that were happening at the time that if you don't have the footnotes, you kind of get lost. Or even, yeah, like, overwhelmed with, wait, what is he talking about here?
Yeah. I also just think that it would be so interesting. I wonder, like, how much in translation, mm-hmm, is different. And I'm like, I want someone who speaks Russian to read the original text and, like, come on the podcast or something.
If you're a fluent Russian speaker and reader, and you are also very well versed in Notes from Underground, reach out. We'd love to have you on so you can tell us how you feel about Richard Pever and Larissa Volokhonsky's interpretation of the original text.
Yeah. That was something I was thinking about. I don't, like, fluently speak any other language, but I bet that would be neat to be able to read a text in its original language, but then also read it, like, the most popular translation, mm-hmm, and, like, see the differences and see what might have been changed or lost or just interpreted differently because of cultural differences. Like,
yeah. So before we get into rating and ranking this book, let's first go through the bookmarks of satire. Let's talk about what things this book is using in order to communicate its message that are also the elements that make it satirical. So if you're new to the podcast, we have 5 distinct literary devices that we look to, or elements of the book that we look to see how satirical is the book. These are all hallmarks of satire. We call them the bookmarks of satire, and not every satirical book uses them, but it's kind of like a good baseline of what is this book doing that made us think of it as being a satirical book. So first up is going to be humor.
Yeah.
Definitely. This is an incredibly funny book. There were a lot of moments of like laughing out loud at this book. He is absolutely utilizing humor, maybe more than almost any other element. Mm-hmm. Next is going to be irony. I think so.
Yeah, I think that the man underground himself is like ironic, exactly. Honestly, as a character. So,
and yeah. The fact that he's using someone who he disagrees with in order to communicate a message that he does, everything is veiled through an ironic lens. Mm-hmm. Next will be exaggeration. And I think definitely he is clearly taking the ideas of Chernyshevsky and exaggerating those ideas to create the man underground. So absolutely exaggeration. Mm-hmm. Next up, ridicule.
Mm-hmm.
Also, yeah, I don't know if we've had a book on the podcast that has been so directly ridiculing something. Yeah. Like, it's not just that Dostoevsky is making fun of an idea. He is making fun of Chernyshevsky specifically.
Yeah. No, that's crazy.
And last up,
and then obviously,
criticism. Is the book making a critical statement?
Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah, it has
5 for 5, hit it out of the park.
5 for 5. This is one of maybe the first, or at the very least one of the few books that we've read that every single element of satire, it is absolutely using them, and all of them it is using in a very pointed way. It's not just that it has it is leaning on them in order to communicate its message, and I think that is really awesome. Now, before we get into our reviews, let's hear some of your reviews. Let's hear about what other people have thought about Notes from Underground. So I've gone on to Goodreads and just found some of the 1-star reviews that people have left this book. Let's see why people who don't like this book do not like it. So I'll send you one, Sid.
Okay, so this review reads, "Where do I start? I trudged through to page 26 and skipped only to find the pitiful moaning of a human being who hated himself, all around him, life in general. Get a job, do some..." "Do some volunteering. Join the Peace Corps. Just get out of the damn basement. I'm sure I'm the only one who didn't get this." You know, I think this reader would love
This is somebody who would really get a lot out of What Is to Be Done, because they want people to do things. Hey, get out of the dang basement.
Get out of the basement and join the Peace Corps. Gosh.
This next 1-star review is relatively succinct. Whine, bitch, moan, complain, whine, cry, bitch, moan, complain.
I mean, yeah, the guy, he is doing that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we've all been there. Everybody has those days. Everybody knows what I'm talking about.
All right. So this 1-star reviewer said, "I gotta give it to Dostoevsky. Takes a lot of balls to have your main character be spiteful, contradictory, mean, and hateful right off the bat on page 1, and have your main character be very, very aware of his flaws. But oh brother, this is not hyperbole. This was truly the longest 100 pages I've ever had to slog through. There's a quote in this book that goes, 'Granted, I am a babbler, a harmless vexatious babbler like all of us. And I just couldn't help but think, well, ain't that the truth?' This novel is so very, very, very verbose. The sentences are so long-winded and extensive that I feel bad for the audiobook narrator. I know for a fact my high school English teachers would faint at the amount of commas in these sentences, some of which add up to 19. Dostoevsky needed an editor." That was honestly really funny.
Yeah.
That was a funny review.
I also am a babbler, a harmless, vexatious babbler. So I sympathize. You know,
they back in the day, we just read some Jane Austen. They do be using commas a lot. Like, I don't know.
They really, I don't know. Them sentences be running. I liked this one a lot because, one, I agree with it in that if you completely hate the main character, I don't know if you're going to like this book. Because if you cannot empathize or sympathize even a little bit with the main character, I don't think the book works. So I totally understand why if you do not like unlikable narrators as a literary device, this is not the book for you. I also thought that it was funny because he's like, Dostoevsky needed an editor, when famously a tremendous amount of this book got cut in editing, and Dostoevsky was really upset about how much his editor had cut out of the book. So I think instead you think that his editor needed an editor.
Yeah.
So this is our last one-star review. Buckle up. So I came across this guy at a party that I had known in college many years ago. I remembered him clearly. That brilliant, pretentious guy with his stories and his sarcasm and his nihilism. Our classmates mocked him and so did I, but I enjoyed him too. He was a funny fellow. Entirely self-absorbed, smart and well-read, and amusingly melodramatic in his comments about the world and his life. He wore his pathos blatantly, like some kind of robe or badge or shield. I always thought that was brave of him, that naked vulnerability so openly displayed. And here he was, many years later, pretty much the same guy, except the years had not been so kind to him. We struck up a conversation and talked about the old days. He asked if I wanted to leave the party and go back to his place, do some drugs. I agreed. His place was a dump, but my place is a little better, just cleaner. He had piles of books stacked everywhere. Mine are kept neatly in bookshelves. The place had a goaty smell, and a musty one too. Like smelling like dust and old food and socks and sweat and semen. I keep my windows wide open all the time to avoid those scents. We sat on his ratty couch, side by side, and began to do line after line. He talked and talked and talked. It was amusing at first. His spiteful and malicious commentary made me smile. Such an odd fellow, so energetic in his negative way, and yet surprisingly self-aware. He talked about how low he was, but that at least he recognized what he was, unlike everyone else. How he was such a worm, an insect, really, that's how he described himself. His life so meaningless and his job so mundane, and the only things he gained pleasure from were books. People were nothing to him. He was nothing to himself. At one point I asked him, "But what do you do with your time besides reading?" He sneered and said, "Not a lot. He's online a lot. He likes the anonymity. The ability to speak his mind and tell people exactly what he thinks about them and their worldviews and their fake happiness and their stupid families and their stupid beliefs and opinions and the stupid way of ignoring how shitty everything really is. They live their fake lives just pretending they are happy. How we are all divorced from life. We are all cripples, every one of us, more or less. We are so divorced from it that we immediately feel a sort of loathing for actual real life and so cannot even stand to be reminded of it. At least he knows the real score. At least he knows how the world works, even as he rejects it." He opened up his laptop to show me some of his favorite posts, and I have to admit that they were sort of funny. He had a way with words, for sure. He also had an enviable collection of porn on his laptop, and we enjoyed that for a while, doing more lines and laughing about all the stupid whores in the world, and weren't they just pathetic, and wasn't everyone just pathetic? We stripped down to our boxers because the room was stifling, and a person can feel pretty hot when they are doing a lot of drugs and watching a lot of porn. At some point, I passed out to the sound of his miserable, ricocheting laughter, like sad little toy gun bullets popping pitifully. I woke up early. The sun wasn't even out. I had fallen asleep on his couch, sitting up, and he had fallen asleep sideways, two things creating one perpendicular shape. I noticed a part of his leg touched my own leg. His naked flesh touched my own bare skin. I looked at that connection and recoiled, appalled. I jumped up from the couch and he moaned fitfully in his sleep, like a child or someone being tortured. I grabbed his laptop and smashed it into his head, again and again, making a red pulp. Still feeling out of sorts, I went to his bathroom to shower. Out of the showerhead poured mud all over me. I bathed in the mud like it was water, rubbing it all over my face and body until I couldn't see any more of it. LOL, what a night.
What? At no point did I know what was going to happen next. So,
I think
that they gave the book one star.
They gave the book one star. I don't know why, other than they hated the main character and thought that he should be killed. But also, hey, you should get into writing short stories or something.
No, that was pretty good. I was locked in.
This is like so much effort to put into making a one-star review for a book where you don't actually like directly review the book. You just like, I think that this reviewer is almost doing what Dostoevsky did of taking an original source and then just making up a narrative in order to say, this is stupid and I'm refuting it. And then they did it in a Goodreads review. So, like, I don't agree with you, but I think that's a good review.
That was fire. That was fire. You should... That could be a... This is a genre. I'm serious. I want people to start... Bring back making fun of people.
No, but bring back bullying.
Like, I want their... Bring back bullying. Like, I want people to start doing that. Taking the main character of a book, writing another story about that main character... If you disagree with, you know, like, I feel like we could do this. This could be an entire subgenre that really could get spicy. It could get heated.
Bring back literary diss tracks. We can't leave Kendrick Lamar hanging out here being the only guy who's putting in the fucking work.
He's carrying it on his back the entire genre.
If you read something that sucks, get out your pen and paper and put belt to ass. Just show them what for.
Would that reviewer like to come on the podcast as well? I'm gonna keep inviting people, because like, I don't know if we agree, but like, that was good.
So with that, let's talk about what you and I feel about this book. I think that I have already talked about this book before we covered it on the podcast, and then I've been somewhat open during the discussions about the book. I love this book. I think this book is awesome. This is up there for me as one of my favorite books that I've ever read, and I very, very much like it. Like, for me, this is a 5-star book. I think it knocks it out of the park. I don't know if at every turn I agree with Dostoevsky or agree with the points that he's making. But I cannot deny that he is making those points very, very well.
Masterfully, yeah. Well, I mean, I haven't reviewed it yet because I haven't finished it. But I feel similarly in that I wouldn't say that at every moment I've been reading it thus far, I've been enjoying every moment of it. But but like American Psycho, I just couldn't get past some of the aspects of that book.
Yeah.
Though I respected it, I was like, too much, too far. This isn't doing it for me. I don't feel that way about this. And I just have like such immense respect for it. I think it is like a masterful piece of satire. And also in terms of like, literary brilliance, other than all the commas. I'm with everyone on this, but it's just like, we've got to get past it because it's what happened in writing at one point. And so I feel like I'll end up giving it 5 stars, but I haven't given it 5 stars yet.
So we'll come back to this, but as of right now, tentatively the first certified Satire Fire banger. Average 5-star read. But even though we're giving it that high of a rating, we do still have to rank this book. For those unfamiliar, we have a growing and ever-expanding list of every satirical book that has ever been written, and it is our mission to someday rank all of them. So we know what is the best satirical book ever written, and arguably even more importantly, what's the worst? No. So right now, our top five is as follows. The fifth best satirical book that we've read is Northanger Abbey by Jane Austen. Number four is American Psycho by Bret Easton Ellis. Number three, Lula Dean's Little Library of Banned Books by Kirsten Miller. Number two, Slapstick by Kurt Vonnegut. And the best book so far, number one, is 1984 by George Orwell. So, Sydney, where would you like to start the bidding? Where do you want to petition having this book ranked?
I think it's better than Slapstick, so.
I agree with that.
It's at least two, and I'm up for 1984 is so, it's 1984 for a reason. Like, we talk about it in every English class across America, at least, and probably in other countries as well. I mean, George Orwell was a British author. It is what it is for a reason, and so I'm like, I don't know, I'm unsure on this one.
I absolutely see where you're coming from, and I have that same kind of thought process, but I think that in my mind, something to keep in mind with that is that I think part of the reason why 1984 is what it is one, it is not a translated work, which automatically gives it a leg up over Dostoevsky. It's going to be more approachable for English classes that you and I would have attended. And also, I think that the criticism and the satire of what 1984 is trying to discuss is much more relatable to us today than what Notes from Underground is talking about. So while I think that if I were introducing somebody to satire for the first time, or if I was leading a high school English class, I would absolutely pick 1984 over Notes from Underground. If I was instead teaching a college history course, 10 times out of 10, I'm going to make people read Notes from Underground. So, like, for me, I think it is, while less notoriously a satirical book and less well known as being like a classic of the genre, I think it's a better book than 1984.
It's a better satire, for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, but this is, yeah, and that's what we're ranking, so that's probably the answer. But 1984 does have just, like, an excellent plot. Like, if we're just talking about the plot, like, it's a good plot, whereas, like,
it's a lot easier to read.
This book is loose on the plot, which is fine. I mean, I feel like it could be one, though. It is a better satire. It's probably, at least in the bookmarks of satire, it's the best satire we've read so far.
Yeah. So I think what I can do is we can put it at number one again with an asterisk. And if after finishing the book you feel strongly that it should get bumped down to two, then we can do that. But for right now, change up of the top five, our new best satirical book that has ever been written is Notes from Underground by Fyodor Dostoevsky, with an average podcast ranking of a tentative five.
Woo! That's so exciting. And we're so close to getting Fahrenheit 451 out of the top 10.
one more book and that bitch is dead. But speaking of next books and what it is that is going to knock Fahrenheit 451 out of the top 10, hopefully, we should talk about what our podcast is going to look like for the next couple of weeks. So, both in respect of your time during the holidays, where you're probably not going to have the bandwidth or the time or the energy to listen to and keep up with a full 3-week series deep dive on a brand new book, we also are not going to necessarily have the bandwidth, time, or energy to do a deep dive on a brand new satirical book. And so instead, for the remainder of the year, just until the new year starts, our next couple of episodes are going to be what we're calling the Satire Fire Stocking Stuffers. These are just going to be one-off interlude-style episodes where we're talking about things that we think are going to be fun for the podcast. So next week, Sydney and I are both coming prepared with a list of our personal five favorite books. Do not necessarily have to be satirical books or anything like that, just our five favorite books, and we're both going to talk about why those books are our favorite. And so if you are looking for a last-minute gift for someone who you love in your life, tune in, and you're going to come away with about 10 suggestions for books that you could get for that person in your life who enjoys reading, but maybe hasn't read some of these books.
Yeah, this should be fun. And these are our five favorites at this moment in time, I would say. It's really hard to nail down five favorite books, but it should be exciting. Also, I want you, when you say the Satire Fire Stocking Stuffers, I want you to put jingle bell sounds in the background.
That, you got you it.
Thanks. and if it sounds stupid, then leave this in so people know that it was my suggestion. Okay. yeah, it should be fun. We're going to do, like Samuel said, there'll be three other fun, kind of more filler, but should be enjoyable episodes. And you'll get to find out what they are week to week, 1 week before.
It's like the advent the advent calendar of podcasts.
Oh yeah. Also, if you celebrate, you know, this episode's coming out on November 30th, which means tomorrow is December 1st. That's really exciting for all the holiday celebrators out there. So if you celebrate any holiday this time of the year, happy holidays. This is our gift to you.
Happy holidays. And as your gift to us, please be sure to tell some friends about this podcast. Be sure to leave us 5 stars wherever you're listening. Leave us a review. Leave us a comment. Anything that you can do to engage is always beneficial to us, and we always really, really appreciate it. Our intro and outro are remixes of the song 48 by Kulla. And Sydney, if folks want to find other ways to wish us happy holidays, where can they reach us?
You can find us on Instagram at the Satire Fire Pod, P-O-D. On TikTok, Blue Sky, and YouTube, we also can be found at the Satire Fire. And follow us. Like, comment, subscribe to the YouTube. Give us your 5 favorite books. We want to learn about you too, and we appreciate any engagement there. And yeah.
Yeah. And if you are trying to get someone to listen to the podcast, just obviously you can find the podcast wherever it is that you have found it. But we are also everywhere that podcasts are found. I personally use Pocket Casts. I think it rocks. It's totally free, no ads, easy to find us and subscribe there. And there's also no ads on our YouTube channel. So if you happen to be listening somewhere with ads and you would like to not be, there's a couple of options for you. But that is going to do it for us for this week. As we say goodbye for now to Fyodor Dostoevsky. We might see you again later. But for this week, that's it. Don't forget to tip your local librarian this holiday season. This has been the Satire Fire. I am Samuel.
I'm Sydney.
And we'll see you next week. Bye.
Bye.
I've just about come to the end of the road. Here, I've just about lost patience with you people. You get your ass out into the mountains or someplace, or hide in there and watch that damn tube. But if not, fuck it. I'm done. In fact, my sermon